So we're working our way through the book of Acts, and we've reached the passage that I read a few moments ago, Acts chapter 18, verses 1-18. And so we're going to be thinking about this passage this morning, and I would like us to do so under two headings. And first of all then, the visit that exceeds expectations. The visit that exceeds expectations. So I'm talking then about Paul's visit to Corinth, of course. We are told in the opening verse of this passage that that's where he headed, having left Athens. We have seen him in Athens over the past couple of Sunday mornings, but having left there, Corinth was his next destination. So why then do I say that this visit to Corinth exceeds expectations? Well, I'm not thinking about Corinth's desperate moral climate, although the moral climate in Corinth was pretty desperate. One commentator describes it as the Las Vegas of the first century world. Nor am I thinking about Corinth's abundance of idol temples, although there was an abundance of idol temples in Corinth. Indeed, the two major landmarks of the place that you couldn't miss as you arrived there were the temples of Aphrodite and Asclepius. But no, I'm thinking of something else here, something that occurs during Paul's visit, which seems very ominous. I'm thinking of the Jewish backlash against Paul's ministry. It's reported in verse 6, they opposed and reviled him. The Jews in Corinth opposed and reviled him. Now that is depressingly familiar, isn't it? It happened in Antioch in Pisidia. It happened in Iconium. It happened in Lystra. It happened in Thessalonica. It happened in Berea. In all those places, Paul faced Jewish opposition. And in each case, then, the Jewish backlash came to dominate and overshadow the whole visit. And against that backdrop, then, when this Jewish opposition erupts here in Corinth in verse 6, we're expecting the same as before. We're expecting this whole visit to Corinth to be dominated and overshadowed by these hostile, antagonistic Jews. We're expecting a recurrence of this disappointing pattern to which we've become so accustomed. But on this occasion, things are different. The visit exceeds our expectations. Rather than dominating and overshadowing things, this Jewish backlash, it ends up being little more than a footnote to what is, in fact, from beginning to end, a very encouraging visit to Corinth. Let's just look at some of the details of that. Notice, first of all, an encouraging discovery. An encouraging discovery. Normally, when Paul visits these cities that he's never visited before, he's very much starting from scratch. Indeed, it's not until he's managed to convert a homeowner to Christ, someone like Lydia in Philippi or Jason in Thessalonica, that he even has a proper place to stay or proper place to use as a base for his missionary activity in the city. But in Corinth, it's different. In Corinth, upon his arrival there, he discovers there's already a Christian couple in the place. This couple, Aquila and Priscilla, they've just arrived there themselves, and they are homeowners. And so from the outset of his visit to Corinth, he does have a place to stay. He does have a place to use as a base. Indeed, it's probably much more secure accommodation than any of the other houses he stayed in other cities. I mean, it's one thing for the Jews in Thessalonica to attack the house of Jason because Paul's staying there. I mean, Jason was a man that they knew, presumably, and whose conversion had happened under their very noses and to their profound irritation. So it's one thing for them to attack the house of Jason where Paul is staying. It's another thing for the Jews in Corinth to attack the house of Priscilla and Aquila, who have just moved into the city, already disciples of Jesus Christ. That's much less likely. And so for Paul then, Aquila and Priscilla, they represent secure accommodation, but of course much more than that. Accommodation then where he's going to receive precious fellowship and companionship and support. So I'm saying then it's an encouraging discovery that Paul makes. There in verse 2, he found a Jew named Aquila with his wife Priscilla. And by the way, can't we all testify to similar encouraging discoveries at various points in our lives? You went off to university, and as you were declining the incessant invitations to pub crawls throughout Freshers Week, you suddenly discovered that there was another Christian on your corridor in the hall of residence who was doing the same. You were on a package holiday, and as you were walking out of the hotel on the Sunday morning to find a local church, Bible in hand, getting funny looks from your fellow holidaymakers, you suddenly spotted another couple who were doing the same. Jeff Thomas says, I was once on a plane flying to New Zealand, and I was talking to the person next to me, and the subject turned to the gospel. And after I got off the flight and was waiting for my luggage, the people who had been sitting behind me came up to me. They were Christians who were listening to all I'd been saying, and they said that they had been praying for me. It's God's kindness to us, isn't it? When he puts another Christian in a place where perhaps we hadn't expected to find another Christian, and we make this encouraging discovery that Paul makes as he arrives in Corinth. So an encouraging discovery. Secondly, an encouraging delivery. An encouraging delivery. Because in fact, it's not just accommodation and fellowship that Paul receives from Aquila and Priscilla, is it? He also gets involved with them in business. They become partners, it seems, in business. We've been getting to know Paul in this book of Acts ever since chapter 7, when he was still Saul the persecutor, and we've discovered all sorts of things about him, haven't we? That he's from Tarsus, that he's a Roman citizen, that he can preach, that he can perform miracles, that he can carry out circumcisions, that he can quote from pagan poets. We've discovered all these things about him. Here now, we discover he has another string to his bow. Paul also has a trade. When necessary, he can earn a living making tents. And it just so happens then that Aquila and Priscilla are involved in the same trade. They make tents too. And so it seems that verse 3 is saying that they pretty much went into business together. Corinth, by the way, was a good place for making tents. Every 2 years, the Isthmian Games were held in Corinth, a huge, huge sporting event, and thousands of people would come to Corinth for that. And like at music festivals today, many of them would stay in tents in these huge fields set aside for that purpose. And so there was much money to be made in Corinth by making tents. And so here's Paul then, and each Sabbath he's in the synagogue preaching and teaching, but Sunday to Friday you'll find him in the workshop with his two colleagues. They're measuring and cutting and stitching as he constructs tents. Or at least initially, that's what you'll find. But then we read in verse 5 these words. When Silas and Timothy arrived from Macedonia, Paul was occupied with the word. In other words, here now, in verse 5, he's no longer combining tent-making and preaching the words. No, here in verse 5, he has given up the former and he has devoted himself to the latter. He's just occupied now with the word. Now, in the ESV here, it sounds as though that's just the situation that Silas and Timothy encountered when they arrived from Macedonia. But I think the NIV has it right. It says this, that when Silas and Timothy arrived from Macedonia, Paul devoted himself to the word. In other words, Silas and Timothy didn't arrive to a situation in which Paul had already devoted himself to the word. Rather, it was Silas and Timothy's arrival that triggered Paul devoting himself to preaching the words. Which raises the question then, well, what was it about Silas and Timothy's arrival that enabled this transition? Well, almost certainly the answer is that Silas and Timothy didn't arrive from Macedonia empty-handed. Rather, they delivered to Paul from the Macedonian churches a substantial gift. Indeed, Paul himself refers to this in 2 Corinthians and chapter 11 and verse 9, where he says to the Corinthians, writing to them much later on, of course, he says, "When I was with you and was in need, I did not burden anyone, for the brothers who came from Macedonia supplied my needs." So, referring there to verse 5 here in Acts 18, it seems. He also refers to it actually in Philippians chapter 4 and verse 15, where he says this, "And you Philippians yourselves know that in the beginning of the gospel, when I left Macedonia, no church entered into partnership with me in giving and receiving except you only." So that's interesting. I said just now that Silas and Timothy brought a gift from the Macedonian churches. Actually, that's inaccurate. It seems from Philippians 4:15, they brought a gift from one church in Macedonia. There were other churches. There was the Thessalonian church that just started. There was the Berean church that just started. Seems like they didn't send any gift. But the one church in Philippi, it sent this gift, which Silas and Timothy now deliver to Paul. It was Lydia and the jailer and their fellow converts in Philippi who dug deep into their pockets and sent Paul a substantial gift, a gift so substantial that it released him from the necessity of making tents and enabled him to concentrate full time on preaching the word. And so it is indeed then an encouraging delivery that Silas and Timothy make as they arrive in Corinth, delivering this material support from Philippi. And by the way, in this connection, the church in Philippi here is reminiscent, is it not, of the church in Antioch that we considered now many weeks ago. Remember how back in chapter 11 of Acts, the church in Antioch sent a gift to the believers in Judea. And when I was preaching on that, I said it was a remarkable gift for three reasons. Number one, these believers in Antioch, they were Gentile believers and they were sending their gift to Jewish believers. Number two, they were vulnerable believers because they themselves were poor and were being affected by the same famine that they were sending their money to Jerusalem to relieve the believers from. But then number three, they were young believers. They'd only just been converted. The church in Antioch had just started, and yet already they were giving. And that same point, point number three, it applies here, doesn't it, with this Philippian church. I mean, it only just begun. We've read about it in chapter 16. It was such a young church. Its theological understanding was doubtless still very limited, confined probably to just the basics of the gospel. And yet already this church in Philippi is generously giving to Paul and his ministry. How come? Well, I explained when preaching on chapter 11 there that, you see, generous giving actually flows from an understanding of just the basics of the gospel. You don't need long years of Christian experience. You don't need great depths of biblical knowledge. It isn't grasping complex doctrines that prompts generous giving. It's simply grasping that the Son of God loved me and gave himself for me. That's the key, because grasping that leads inevitably to the conclusion, love so amazing, so divine, demands my soul, my life, my all. I wonder, are we generous with our material resources? Do we dismiss that kind of thing as being for super mature veteran Christians who've been on the road much longer than we have? Or has the gospel of extravagant grace, the gospel of a crucified Saviour, gotten hold of us and compelled generosity in us, as it had in these neophyte Christians in Philippi? So an encouraging discovery, an encouraging delivery. Thirdly, an encouraging decision. An encouraging decision. So I've already mentioned the Jewish opposition that Paul's ministry arouses there in verse 6, and Paul's subsequent avoidance of the synagogue, his withdrawal from teaching there, that it seems does little to appease the Jews. They may not have to listen to Paul now every Sabbath as they had been doing originally, but they're still very conscious, it seems, of his presence. In fact, he's only next door in the house of Titius Justus. That's where the new Christian community is meeting to have its services, it seems. And so they're still very conscious of Paul, still very irritated by him. And perhaps the final straw then is when the ruler of the synagogue, Crispus, verse 8, and his family all become believers and join Paul and join the Christian community. That's perhaps the final straw. And the upshot then is that in verse 12, the Jews make this united attack on Paul. They seize him and they force him to appear before the proconsul Gallio. And so Gallio then, like the magistrates in Philippi in chapter 16, and like the city authorities in Thessalonica in chapter 17, he now has to pronounce his official judicial decision. Of course, the magistrates in Philippi, they had ordered Paul's beating and imprisonment. The city authorities in Thessalonica, they had ordered a monetary payment from Jason. And so we're thinking that probably Gallio, like them, he's going to be pretty hard on Paul. He's going to take the side of the accusers, surely. He's going to give Paul a hard time. That's what we're anticipating. But it doesn't happen like that, does it? In fact, the hearing is almost over before it's even started. Gallio isn't interested in the accusations that have been brought against Paul. He dismisses them as beneath his consideration. As far as he's concerned, they have to do with intricate Jewish matters that are of no real consequence to him and to his city. It's purely anti-Semitism, probably, that is driving Gallio here. You notice how we're told in verse 2 of the chapter that anti-Semitism was operating at the very highest level of Roman government at this point. Claudius, the emperor, was expelling Jews from the imperial city, from Rome, and so we shouldn't be surprised if something of that anti-Jewish sentiment has filtered down to the lower levels of Roman government, like this proconsul in Corinth, Gallio. And so he's probably just prejudiced against the Jews when he says what he says here at this hearing of Paul's. And when he says that it's a matter of questions about words and names and your own law in verse 15, he's not actually saying, well, legal minutiae don't interest me. I'm sure in some context, legal minutiae would have interested Gallio very much indeed, but his point is, it's your little law, you little Jews. I'm not interested in your law. I'm not interested in you. You go and sort this problem out yourselves. You're just Jews. That's probably the attitude of the man, which is why in verse 17 we read of him just turning a blind eye as Sosthenes, the ruler of the synagogue, is beaten before his very eyes, right in front of him. You would have thought he would intervene, he would do something, but again, probably not, because Sosthenes is a Jew, and these are Jews who are just having their own little fight, and he doesn't care about the Jews. But be that as it may, the fact is then that Paul has no case to answer. He can walk away a free man. It's an encouraging decision from this powerful official who could have seriously punished Paul had he been minded to do so. So an encouraging discovery, an encouraging delivery, an encouraging decision. But then fourthly, an encouraging duration. An encouraging duration. There's that famous stage direction in Shakespeare's The Winter's Tale, Exit Pursued by a Bear. And whenever Paul visits a place on this second missionary journey, it's a fairly good bet that he won't be there long, and that pretty soon he will exit, perhaps not pursued by a bear, but pursued by somebody or other. I don't know whether Paul was an easy guest to accommodate for Lydia and Jason and these others who accommodated him, whether he was a fussy eater or a heavy snorer or anything like that. But one problem you were unlikely to have with Paul as your guest was him outstaying his welcome, because he was generally in a place for such a short time before being chased out of town. In Corinth, however, it's quite different, isn't it? Verse 11 seems to indicate that a year and a half elapsed before the Gallio incident. And then you go down to verse 18, and that refers to many days passing after the Gallio incident. So it may well have been pushing on for 2 years that Paul stayed in Corinth before then leaving in verse 18 on his own terms, at his own leisure, altogether unconstrained by any enemies or authorities. It's an encouraging duration, I'm saying, the sheer length of time that Paul stays in Corinth. So, I'm saying then that despite this Jewish backlash against Paul, which elsewhere has such ramifications, this visit to Corinth exceeds expectations and is encouraging in all these ways that I've just set out before you. And so we need to ask, well, how come? Why in this case is the Jewish backlash merely a footnote? How in a city where the Jews are up in arms and we're expecting that to cloud everything, how do things in fact go so well? Well, we must move on to our second heading. We've seen the visit that exceeds expectations, but secondly, we must notice the vision that explains everything. The vision that explains everything. I'm referring, of course, to the vision Paul has in verses 9 and 10, where the Lord addresses him. And the Lord who addresses him almost certainly is Jesus. In Acts, indeed in the New Testament generally, the Lord refers to Jesus. And indeed, the same Lord has been referred to just a verse earlier in verse 8, where it's clearly the Lord Jesus in whom Crispus believed. So here we have this vision then, Jesus addressing Paul. In terms of its physical positioning, it's right in the very center of our passage. There are 8 verses before it, there are 8 verses after it. And in terms of the passage's meaning, I think it's at the very center also. All the unexpected encouragement and success that I've just been talking about in my first point, all of that revolves around these words that Jesus speaks to Paul in this nocturnal vision. There are 3 things particularly that we need to understand here. Jesus' claim. There in verse 10, I have many in this city who are my people. I have many in this city who are my people. It's an extraordinary statement that. Jesus is saying there that he has a considerable number of people in Corinth who at this point are still full-blown card-carrying pagans. At this point, they are drunkards propping up the bars in Corinth every night. At this point, they are corrupt businessmen defrauding their customers and clients. At this point, they are practicing homosexuals. At this point, they are prostitutes in the idol temples. At this point, they are ruthless landowners who mistreat their slaves. That's who they are at this point. And yet, Jesus here refers to them as my people. these pagans who are living utterly immoral lifestyles in Corinth, Jesus says, they are my people. It's an extraordinary claim. It's almost a disorientating claim. It seems to undermine the most basic things that we know as Christians. It's like someone coming along one day and saying to us that white is black, or black is white. Christ's people are by definition, surely, those who have been regenerated by the Holy Spirit and who have believed the gospel and who are trusting in Jesus Christ. And yet here are all these people in Corinth who are certainly not doing that. They're still living these outrageous pagan lifestyles. They have no interest in the gospel. They perhaps never heard the gospel yet. And yet they're being described as Christ's people. And it raises the question then, well, how are these people Christ's people? If they're not believers, and their hearts are dead in trespasses and sins, how can he call them my people? Well, they are his on at least a couple of grounds. They are his on the ground that his Father has given them to him. Think of that passage with which we began our service this morning, John chapter 17, and Jesus' prayer in that passage. And you know the flow of his prayer and how he prays for his disciples, those who have been his disciples on earth. He prays for them to start with. But then he continues, doesn't he, in verse 20, he moves on. I don't ask for these only, but also for those who will believe in me through their word. And so now he's looking forward to future Christians, people who are not Christians at this point when he's praying. And then he describes them in verse 24, the verse I quoted at the start of our service, in this way. He says, Father, I desire that they also, so these ones who are in the future and they're not believers yet, I desire that they also, whom you have given me, may be with me where I am. They're not believers yet, these people he's praying for, but they're his, because the Father has given them to him. I think he's talking probably about an eternal arrangement. Before time began, the Father, in that eternal arrangement or covenant that the Father and Son made concerning salvation, the Father then gave a people to Jesus for him to save. They had been given to him by the Father, and so they were his people in that sense. And then, for another thing, they were his people in that he had purchased them on the cross. By Acts 18, Jesus had already died on the cross, already purchased these many people in the city with his blood, paid for their sins. And so, in those two ways then, these people in Corinth who are still dead in trespasses and sins, they are Christ's people. We think, don't we, of conversion as this huge, momentous, seismic thing. And in some ways, of course, it is. But in another way, it's actually a formality. It's a tying up of loose ends, these great transactions that have already taken place. In eternity, the Father giving people to his Son. On the cross, his Son paying for those people. Actually, then them coming to faith, that's just a formality. That's just the tying up of the loose ends. That's inevitable. That's got to happen. In all the most important respects, these people are already Christ's, because he's already been given them and he's already bought them. It's a striking thought, that, isn't it? That there are people in your family and in your street and in your workplace and in your social circle, perhaps, who at this point are utterly dead in trespasses and sins, and they seem as far away from being Christians as it's possible to be. And yet some of those people, they've already been given by the Father to the Son in eternity. They've already been paid for on the cross. They are Christ's people in all the most important respects. All that remains is for him to actually bring them to faith in himself. So it's a striking claim Jesus makes. Jesus' claim, but then the second thing we need to understand is Jesus' control. Jesus' control. You see, it's all very well then, Jesus saying these people in Corinth who haven't yet believed, that they're my people. But if they are going to then come to faith, well, Paul has to go and evangelize them and take the gospel to them. And frankly, that doesn't look all that likely. I mean, here he is, and he's arriving in Corinth, and he has no one there that he knows, and he has no base, nowhere to stay. And then for another thing, he has to make tents to earn a living, and so he's not going to be able to really devote himself to preaching the gospel. And then for another thing, there are these Jews who are so opposed, and they're probably going to take him to the proconsul and he'll drive Paul out of the city or put him in prison or something like that. And so for another thing, he'll only probably be there for a few days or weeks, and then that'll be it. Well, no, Jesus is in control, and so he can change all of those things. And for one thing, he can make sure there's a couple already in Corinth, Aquila and Priscilla, so that Paul can stay in their house. And for another thing, he can put it in the hearts of Christians in Philippi to send a gift so that Paul doesn't have to make tents. And for another thing, he can cause Gallio, out of anti-Semitism perhaps, to make a decision in favor of Paul. And so for another thing, he can cause Paul's stay to be 2 years rather than just a few weeks. Jesus is in control of all these things. In fact, I think our passage hints at the fact that he is in control with a control that's divine, actually. There are hints in our passage as to the deity of Jesus. For one thing, the way he speaks to Paul there in that vision, don't be afraid, I am with you, no one will attack you. It's very similar language to Jeremiah 1, verse 8, where Yahweh is commissioning Jeremiah. He says very similar things to him. That's Yahweh speaking. And here's Jesus taking on his lips the same words that Yahweh has used, because Jesus is Yahweh. He is Jehovah. He is God. And then you have Paul's interesting vow at the end of the passage in verse 18. At Kentria, he cuts his hair, for he was under a vow, probably related to the vision. After the vision, he had made a vow, probably, that he would abstain from alcohol and he would refrain from cutting his hair. He would live as a Nazarene until he left Corinth, perhaps to kind of express his trust, his faith in the vision he'd received, and perhaps to thank Jesus for giving him this vision. In recognition of that, I'm going to do this. I'm going to abstain from these things. I'm going to be under a vow for the rest of my time here. But the point is, that's what Jews did toward God. They took these vows in relation to God, and here's Paul taking it in relation to Jesus, who has given him the vision, because Jesus is God. And so Jesus is in control of all these things. In other words, these people who have been given to him by the Father in eternity, for whom he has paid with his blood on the cross, he is able to close in on them all. There they are in Corinth, and Paul has to get to them with the gospel, and that seems so unlikely. How is Paul going to get to them with the gospel? He'll be chased out of the city in just a few days' time. No, he won't. Jesus will make sure that everyone in Corinth who is his, by covenant and by purchase, everyone is reached by Paul with the gospel. Because Jesus can do that. He's in control. Jesus isn't going to face a situation the last day where the Father says to him, hang on a minute, I gave you such and such a number of people and you laid down your life for them. Why aren't they all here? Why aren't they all saved? Why didn't they all come to trust the gospel? And Jesus will have to kind of shuffle sheepishly and look all embarrassed. Oh, well, I'm afraid that person, I couldn't reach them. That's not going to happen. Jesus will irresistibly and invincibly close in on every last person whom he has purchased and who has been given to him by the Father, because he's in control of all circumstances. And no one can frustrate him, not the Jews in Corinth, not Gallio in Corinth. not economic considerations because Paul has to make tents. Nothing can frustrate him. Jesus will get everyone that he has purchased. But that takes us lastly to another aspect of the vision we mustn't overlook, Jesus' command. Jesus' command. You see, these facts then that Jesus has a people in Corinth, given to him in eternity, paid for on the cross, and to whom he will inevitably close in on, that doesn't lessen the importance of Paul reaching those people with the gospel. And so Jesus commands, don't be afraid, but go on speaking. Yes, they are Christ's people. And yes, their conversions are inevitable. But Paul must still take the gospel to them. And there's such an incongruity about all this when you remember how Paul writes, doesn't he, to these believers in Corinth in 1 Corinthians 2. In 1 Corinthians 2:3, he says, I was with you in weakness and in fear and in much trembling. That was how Paul preached the gospel in Corinth. Weakness, fear, trembling. And there's such an incongruity then. On the one hand, we're saying, here's this irresistible, mighty, divine Jesus who will get every one of his people in that city of Corinth. And on the other hand, here's his instrument. This weak, trembling, knee-knocking apostle Paul. But you see, that's what gives Paul the courage to go on, isn't it? The fact he knows that even through his weak preaching, Jesus will fulfill his mighty, divine, irresistible purposes. That's why we should be encouraged to keep on spreading the gospel of Jesus in all our weakness, in all our trembling and our lack of courage. We should be encouraged to keep going because Jesus has a people given him, paid for, and he will reach them, and he will use us, and we will be his instruments of reaching those who are his people. And so the command isn't, don't worry, Paul, I have a people, therefore you just step to one side. The command is, I have a people, therefore, Paul, keep on speaking. And that's a great message for us this morning. Christ has a people, and not one of those people will go unsecured. He will grab hold of each one that is his, but he will do so through us. And he says to us this morning, keep on speaking, keep on spreading the gospel, precisely because I have a people. Amen.